Hello, I'm Conrad Vance, and welcome to the second episode of the Affairs Current podcast. Our email is theaffairscurrent@gmail.com. Our blog is theaffairscurrent.blogspot.com. Today I have with me from the first episode, rejoining us, is Edward Roy. How are you, Edward?
I'm good. How are you, Carter?
I'm really all right. And the other co-host we have today is my good friend and active, on the Canadian political scene, Alex Hill. Why don't you introduce yourself to the people of the internet, Alex?
Hi, my name is Alex Hill. I am a high school teacher in South Korea, and previously, before moving to Asia, I was heavily involved in the Green Party of Ontario as a candidate in the 2011 as well as 2014 elections, and also pretty involved federally with the Greens.
Okay, perfect. So that's really good, because today on the show we're going to be discussing just two topics, the first of which is the Canadian election. I know that some people who listened to the first episode said, well, you know, you're trying to make this Canadian podcast, there is an election going on, why weren't you really talking about that? Maybe we thought it wasn't appropriate to jump right in there. And then the second topic we'll be talking about is Jeremy Corbyn's rise to success as the UK leader of the UK Labour Party and subsequent developments there. But if you have any feedback, we got a pretty good response from the first episode. But if you do have any further feedback about audio quality, about topics we should discuss, and if you'd like to be involved in the show, once again, that email is theaffairscurrent@gmail.com. And go to theaffairscurrent.blogspot.com for all of the show notes and links and recommended readings that will come out of this episode. So the first topic I want to discuss with you gentlemen is the Canadian federal election, but I don't want to do horse race here. I kind of want to throw this in a bit of a different direction and ask a broad question, which is this election about nothing? Because, you know, there's been a lot of developments around what the topics of interest in this election, I suppose, have been. But then there was a really, I would say, quite blistering and quite sobering article that came out a few days ago from, oddly enough, Maclean's of all places, where, and I'm just going to read an excerpt from this article, and I'll ask you subsequently if you think it rings true. It says, party leaders build their campaigns on these isolated, focused announcements, small promises for small men and women, them and us, because the strategy only works if we respond, and we do. We respond because we are nothing more than a collection of interest groups. We are dairy farmers or oil workers, urban or rural, francophone or anglophone, Manitobans or Nova Scotians. But we are not a people, not a nation, not really. If we were, we would not be able to ignore each other, ignore Canadians the way we ignore the Aboriginal community. We would not allow our politicians to reduce us to Pavlovian demographics, salivating at the sight of a specially crafted handout. We would be unleashing a full-throated cry of anger and dismay that so many fellow Canadians are growing up alone and lost, that so many of us are living in abject poverty and then dying miserably. We would shout down every stump speech about the quote-unquote struggling middle class and demand more for the least fortunate among us. We would scream frustration as yet another young Aboriginal is found hanging unnamed and unmourned. But we don't. We just stand there, heads down, hands out. I don't know who to be more ashamed of, our politicians or us. So, I mean, that article was framed around the specific fact that there's been a lack of discussion about the Aboriginal community and the really dire poverty that exists in those communities and the violence and lack of hope and opportunity. But really, it's kind of a broader question about, you know, the nature of democracy, I suppose. And I'll throw to Alex, firstly, is, I guess, has democracy in this election been reduced to, you know, basically what can you give me as a special interest group, and not any kind of broader consideration of where the country is going?
Yeah, I think the analysis that you just quoted in Maclean's was spot on, and it's basically the essence of retail politics. Democracy, the art of politics, has been reduced to an exercise in consumerism of the most crass nature. And I think it's a disservice to ourselves and to our country. But after I read that article, the first thing that I thought of was Churchill's quote, "The best argument against democracy is a 5-minute conversation with the average voter." And in moments like that, when we look at the state of our federation, the plight of indigenous peoples, and the huge issues and groups that we don't mention, it really puts us to shame, I think. And we should be thinking about a range of issues. They're not being addressed by any of the major parties, and that's only going to do us damage.
Okay. So I'll throw it to everyone, but I just want to make a kind of leading question, I suppose, from that. Has it always been this way, or is there something new that's happening in this election, or even, let's say, previous elections to this? Like, was there ever a point in either Canadian democracy or Western democracy generally where it wasn't the case that politicians were micro-targeting demographics, making specific pitches, and that, you know, the act of democracy was just sort of like selling soap, as that quote goes? You know, was there ever an election where there was some, quote, big driving issue that was really moving people's votes, or has it always been, well, what can you do for me?
Well, I suppose it kind of depends, because we've centered in on two issues here. You know, one is obviously the micro-targeting, and the other is the issues that get all but ignored. I mean, the question in particular of, you know, relations with Aboriginal people, I mean, that's never really been a central issue of Canadian election going back to Confederation and even before. You're always, and in any given society, you're going to have a group, typically a minority group, like the Aboriginals, an ethnic minority of some kind, who is small enough that they are not taken into account by politicians. There's no votes to be won in trying to solve their problems. 'Cause let's remember, democracy is, you know, it's the rule of the majority. Politicians only have to appeal to, they don't have to appeal to everyone, they just have to appeal to a large enough group to get elected. And since Aboriginal people only represent about 5% of the Canadian population, that's a group whose issues politicians have been able to ignore since as long as we've had elections in this country. But the part that I will say is new is I think the micro-targeting is getting a lot more specific, a lot more systematized. I mean, 2 years ago in 2013... one of the top sort of Canadian political bestsellers of the year was a book called Shopping for Votes by Susan Delacourt. And that was very much talking about how new developments in terms of technology, polling, profiling of groups and even individual voters has allowed politicians to very specifically craft their policy so that, you know, it will appeal to exactly the segment of voters that they need. One particular, you know, just a example taken out of many, you know, I recall earlier in the election, the Conservatives said they would introduce a sort of tax break, tax write-off for people who are a member of groups like the Rotary Club, stuff like that. Which, I mean, might be great policy. Those folks might deserve a tax break. It's, to be honest, it's not an issue I would know a great deal about. But just in the way that it's so specific like that, you can almost just imagine the conservative strategists sitting around a table saying, all right, here's the demic we need to go out, the demographic we need to go after. We need the Rotary votes, so, you know, let's get something for them.
But I mean, you know, this is a long-standing tradition in Canadian politics. I mean, very famously, the Liberal Party throughout the 60s and 70s would run totally different campaigns in Quebec and the rest of Canada, right, in terms of the slogans they would use, the policies they would promise. And at that point, because of, you know, we didn't have the internet and the way communications channels were sort of controlled and targeted, in a lot of cases, people just didn't know what they were saying in the different provinces, so it kind of held. Nowadays, you know, you can't really, I mean, you can still do it that way, and parties still do. Certainly, there's been a lot of talk about how, you know, the NDP in particular is sort of two-faced about the way they present their position on Quebec sovereignty in Quebec and the rest of Canada, right? So certainly that still exists to some degree, but I think you've really hit on something there, Edward, about this whole point about self-interest. And there's a particularly kind of, I guess, disturbing example of it, which kind of ties in with something we were talking about in the previous episode, about the Canadian relationship with Saudi Arabia. Basically during the one, there was, during the first French language debate, I said when we were talking about that in the previous episode, you know, no one's really bringing this up, et cetera, et cetera. And Thomas Mulcair, to his credit, actually did bring that up as a point in that debate, saying, like, you're selling these LAVs to the Saudis. How does this reflect on our policy, our standing in terms of human rights in the world? And then the very interesting thing that happened was it subsequently got into the press that basically the head of the union local in Windsor, I believe, where these LAVs are being constructed, said to...
London,
excuse me. Where these LAVs are being constructed, basically said to Mulcair, or just the NDP leadership more generally, just, you know, shut up, don't talk about this, because it's going to cost our workers their jobs. So, I mean, and, you know, I'm not saying this to be anti-union necessarily, because it could be any other interest group that was doing this, but it just really shows you that even these ostensibly progressive groups, are really in a lot of ways just looking out for themselves, or at least the people they represent, and they're not really taking into account this broader picture. But then I thought about it more, and, you know, I don't know if it's ever been the case that an electorate is driven by a kind of broader picture about something. I think in a lot of cases that's a narrative that's applied backwards to an election by people looking at it in retrospect, right? Like, for example, we think of the 1988 election as being entirely driven by the question of, like, free trade and the relationship with the United States, right? That's how it's all framed. No, it was a referendum on free trade, and the Tories won on that basis. But the fact is, like, and I don't know this, but if you go back into that election, I'm sure that the way it was being presented in terms of the thing was not this grand ideological kind of argument about the merits and demerits of free trade as a system. It was, you know, are your jobs going to be affected by free trade? Is your standard of living going to be enhanced or, made worse by free trade? All that kind of thing. I don't know if these sort of narratives of politics really play into anything. And, you know, frankly, I mean, you could say this is a flaw with democracy, I guess, is that, people ultimately, in a lot of ways, are self-interested when they vote. And, you know, this is the problem, is when you get into having that self-interest plus this intense micro-targeting that Edward was talking about, it can lead to this really deracinated form of politics where you're just saying, you know, give a tax credit to these guys, give another subsidy to this company to keep these people employed, you know. But Alex, why don't you chime in here to get some commentary?
Well, I do think we have to be very careful, and you might be surprised to hear this coming from me, about romanticizing the past. If you look at the state of political discourse and debate 50 or 100 years ago, it was not necessarily less raucous. Self-interest certainly still played a role. It always has. What has changed is the level of quality in the debate, I would argue. We used to elect members of parliament like Edmund Burke and John Stuart Mill. And today we have Andy Wang running for office in suburban Ottawa and his mentor, Pierre Poilievre. To me, that is not the height of democratic sophistication. And I think people deserve better. I would say, though, that what has changed is the level of pandering and the specificity of the pandering. And not only does that do sort of spiritual damage to the body politic, but it also causes very concrete problems from a public policy standpoint. One example would be the tax system. One popular way to target specific groups is through tax credits.
God forbid in these days that government should actually make spending promises, because we know government always has to be smaller and we need to rein it in and take care of the debt and the deficit. So tax credits seem to be the way to go if you want to reward a given group. The problem is that is a massively inefficient and idiotic way of crafting policy, but ultimately that does not matter. And again, because most voters seem to be going to the ballot asking what government can do specifically for them and how government will affect their bottom line, rather than asking bigger questions about public policy, Canada's role in the world, what have you, that's the type of politics that sells. And so that's what politicians are peddling. The final point that I would bring up is that the groups which politicians are targeting are not actually representative of the average Canadian. And that's another big problem. You know, for all this talk of pandering to the ethnic vote and how immigration is becoming a bigger and more important reality and it's changing the political landscape, the people being targeted by these sort of retail-style politics are people like asbestos miners in Quebec. How many asbestos miners do you know? And think about the effect that the federal government's policy vis-a-vis the asbestos industry, what effect does that have on Canada's international standing? You know, what does that say about our values? And what direct impact does that have on the lives of hundreds of thousands or millions of workers in the third world who are buying and using this stuff, right? So whether it's dairy farmers or police officers, or asbestos miners, oftentimes these cleavages, these wedges, directly affect only a small number of people. And that's another reason why I think we should be alarmed about this style of politics. The ordinary working Canadian, or now literally the millions of Aboriginal people in this country, are not being directly impacted by these tax credits and by these wedge issues. So I think actually in a counterintuitive way, if we return to a more holistic approach to public policy, we'd actually end up engaging many, many more people. And I think you would see as a result, voter turnout go up, and you might, maybe it's naive to hope, but you might see a more substantive public discourse.
Well, I'm going to throw to Edward now. I'm going to make my opinion note on this, like, subsequently, but I just want to ask you first. Do you, like, we've kind of said, you know, all the parties are pandering, all of them are engaging in this micro-targeting. With all that said, do you still see really concrete differences between the parties in terms of policy approaches in a wider sense? Like, is this election, again, I asked the question, is this election actually about anything?
Well, I think there are some differences between the parties. Certainly, the between the main opposition parties, the Liberals and the New Democrats and the Conservatives, I think there are measurable differences there. I mean, you just have to look at the degree to which so many of the policy announcements by the Liberals or the NDPs at this point basically amounts to promising to repeal another thing that the Conservatives have brought in over the past little while. Although I think it is interesting to note that in a lot of ways, the Liberals and the NDP are very, very close on most issues. There are probably the biggest divergence between them is economics at this point, where, you know, MoCare is promising more or less balanced budgets, whereas Trudeau wants to get into deficit spending, more stimulus. And there are some other sort of quirks, for instance, on questions of the Senate, on questions of, you know, Quebec sovereignty and the whole 50% plus one question. But those are not quite as concrete, not quite as big, and not necessarily going to affect as many people. But on so many other issues, the environment, climate, or climate change, if you prefer, bringing in proportional representation, the Canadian intervention in Syria and Iraq, they seem to be very, very similar. And it's interesting in that this is, you know, I would almost be, if I were really cynical, be inclined to, you know, place this in a longer tradition where really the NDP as they were for a while. I mean, now they're actually going down in the polls, but for a while they were riding high. They were even, the best polling party in the country. But then the Liberals adopted a lot of the same policies that the NDP had been sort of the first one to bring forward. And this is, I think, very much a function of our party system going a long way back. You could even go back to, say, the 40s, where one thing I remember quite interesting was at one point in around 1943 or so, the CCF, the predecessor to the NDP, obviously, was polling very well. People were even talking about the next government of Canada could be run by the CCF. And Mackenzie King took note of this. Mackenzie King, who up until this point had been fairly centrist or right-wing economically, not doing a great deal to expand the welfare state. But then, seeing this, he sort of came up with the idea of the baby bonus, and was suddenly running to sort of capitalize on the vote that would otherwise have gone to the CCF. So I think we are, to an extent, seeing history repeating itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so I'm going to declare my interest. Like, I do support the New Democrats. I have for quite a long period of time. With that being said, it's interesting, Edward, that you didn't mention C-51 in terms of your differences between the parties. And there's one other issue I'll bring up subsequently, but that's, kind of, if I'm going to game this, that's what it came to, what it comes down to for me, is that there's one party, I should say, in fairness, in deference to Alex, there is one party of the three major parties that is committed to appealing that bill. I think that's a really core question. Shaking his head here. It's a really core question of civil liberties. I think that's a really important difference between the parties. The other thing, and it's kind of an interesting thing, and I think, this has only come up in the past couple of days, has been differences between the Liberals and the NDP on the Trans-Pacific Partnership agreement, where Mulcair, now this was only a couple of days ago, and perhaps it's, you could say it's a desperate attempt to shore up his base or whatever you may think, but he did subsequently come out and say, look, an NDP government is not necessarily going to be pledged to honor an agreement that's brokered by the Conservatives in the course of this election. We have a lot of skepticism about this deal, et cetera, et cetera. And I've written for blogs that I write for about, even if you are pro-free trade, the Trans-Pacific Partnership has a lot of problematic aspects to it. And it's arguable that it's not even necessarily a trade deal in the normal sense that that word is understood. But nevertheless, I think those are some concrete differences there. But I want to throw to Alex on one final point, and I'm loath to bring this up because I don't even think it should be an issue. But the fact of the matter is that the Conservatives have been making a lot of hay recently, basically doing a pretty divisive tactic about niqabs at citizenship ceremonies. The people sitting in this Skype call and anybody who listens to this probably is going to think this is cynical politics, blah, blah, blah. Who are we to say? But look at the public polling. 85% of the Canadian public agrees with the Conservative / Bloc Québécois, I should say, position on this. And it really does seem to be driving at least some percentage of voters in that direction, particularly in Quebec. I guess I'll just kind of ask you a general opinion on that, but as a specific question, maybe, doesn't that speak to a kind of like, has the majority of the Canadian public really, or any public really, accepted the idea of like basic liberalism, I guess? Like, is that something that people just don't really agree with, and they think that a law can be made on a purely sort of moral / cultural basis?
In order for liberalism to survive and flourish, you need a civic culture that is fundamentally supportive of the basic tenets of liberalism, right? That's why you can't invade a country like Iraq or Afghanistan, install a government, hold elections, and then hope everything will work out. But at the end of the day, the most important
aspect of a liberal democracy is liberal democratic institutions. And if Canada had ever relied in the past on people's opinions in order to shore up its liberal values, Canada as we know it would not exist, right? The courts, the bureaucracy, watchdogs, ministries, you know, NGOs all play an extremely important role in upholding our democracy. Now we have the Charter, Human Rights Code. So I don't know if Canadian opinion has shifted dramatically. I think the current conversation, if you can call it a conversation, it's more like the ravings of a deluded Islamophobe. If that conversation is taking place, it's because the opposition and perhaps the media have failed to make this an election about the economy. We're in a recession. How much discussion do you hear about that at the moment? Now, I'm an ocean away, but from my reading of the press, not that much. The focus seems to be on the horse race of politics, and because of that, the niqab has dominated. But I don't think that the Canadian opinion has changed that much. If you look at Canadian support for the mission in Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks, it was quite high. Once Canadian soldiers, as they are wont to do in a war, started dying, public opinion changed. So people have a tendency to support an idea if it sounds good, at least superficially. Once they realize the implications of the policy or idea in question, their opinion will change. So I'm not that alarmed by it, or as alarmed as some people with any measure of faith in the people might be. But one final question I would pose, a sort of rhetorical question, is if indeed the niqab and burqa stand fundamentally opposed to Canadian values, whatever those are, why not ban the burqa? What is this fixation around the burqa and the niqab at citizenship ceremonies? People have already asked the question about why this is necessary for security reasons in the first place, and that's a valid question. But I think the more important issue is, why don't we just go one step further, put all our cards on the table, and follow continental Europe?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the real answer to that is that there's a particular cynicism on the part of the conservative position about this, right? Because they want to drag this through the court system with all these kind of little pieces so that they can keep fighting court battles and keep raising money off of it because, you know, oh, the liberal courts won't let us da-da-da-da-da, you know, stand up for Canadian values. So they put it in these little pieces, and they don't just go ahead and say, you know, let's ban the burqa outright, you know. I'll get to you in 1 second, Edward. And the second thing I'll say is that, you know, and I'll throw this to Edward in a minute, is that, you know, a lot of that sort of debate is really a proxy debate for another sort of thing, which is to say that basically what that turns on is what the limits of multiculturalism are, right? Like where Canadians see the limits of that policy, if that's a good policy or a bad policy. The thing is, the Conservatives don't actually come out and say that what they want is a more assimilationist approach towards new Canadians, right? Like, they just don't come out and directly say that, even though that's the underlying sort of implications of everything they're doing, right? And that's also, to a large degree, because one of the successful things that Stephen Harper has been able to do is bring in those, you know, what you would say, ethnic communities that have traditionally voted liberal. He's brought those on. But he also wants to appeal to a certain kind of conservative base that does want a more assimilationist immigration policy. And look, I'm not even saying that as, like, those people are necessarily bigoted. It's just to say that, like, yeah, some people might want a more assimilationist, like, integration policy. You know, multiculturalism is actually a relatively new policy innovation in the spectrum of Canadian history. Prior to the 60s, assimilationism was the stated government objective of, you know, for when people from the Ukraine or when people from Italy or Croatia or wherever it was came to Canada. It was an assimilationist approach. Now, I don't agree with that approach, but certainly we could have a debate about that. The problem is we're not actually even having a debate about that. I will now throw to Edward.
Yeah. So actually, if I could come back a little bit about, you mentioned the way that the conservatives are approaching the niqab issue, that they're essentially dragging it through the courts. And unfortunately, I can't claim to have had this sort of thought myself, but there is an interesting thing I'd like to bring to the conversation. Chantal Hébert, in her most recent column for L'Actualité magazine, raised a really interesting point about this niqab debate, where she was basically inserting it into the longer history that the conservatives have had since they came to power of quarreling with the courts. We've seen innumerable instances where their very sort of tough on crime policies have run up against the charter and been struck down by the courts. Stephen Harper has, by and large, sort of he's grumbled about it a little bit, but he hasn't, you know, he sort of said, well, it's the courts, we have to accept it even if it's not what we'd like. But of course, the charter also has the notwithstanding clause, which almost no federal government has invoked since the charter was brought in. I might not be 100% correct when I say that, but it's certainly not something that's understood as normal. And Hébert proposed the idea, and she says that this is something that certain conservative thinkers have been talking about for some time, that with this niqab issue, where, as you pointed out, 85%, according to a poll, which I think we should say is a couple of months old, but probably broadly accurate, want to ban the niqab from the citizenship ceremonies. So whereas, say, some of perhaps his the harsher criminal policies, who knows how they would have pulled. But this is something where, you know, it's not just conservatives. There are, you know, if we're honest, people who would probably vote liberal, and even one imagines some people who would be voting NDP, who by those numbers just mathematically must agree with this. So she says, you know, what if this becomes sort of a test case, sort of a way to break the ice, and what if they do end up invoking the notwithstanding clause to ban the niqab from citizenship ceremonies as a way of sort of establishing a precedent which could then be used by the conservatives to advance other elements of their agenda which have been struck down by the courts. I actually just read that the other day. Like I say, that was Chantal Hébert who sort of proposed that idea, and I think if you look at it, it's a very interesting possibility.
Well, that's very interesting, Edward. If you were ever going to do it, break that ice, this would seem to be the issue to do it on, where you have the public almost entirely on side with you. I guess I would appreciate it if, as Alex said, this debate were conducted in an honest fashion. Because, like, let's be honest, anybody who wants to ban the niqab at citizenship ceremonies is probably not going to feel too sore if you move that into a more general sort of thing of banning the niqab entirely, like has been done in Belgium or France or other places like that. So I guess, you know, part of me, you know, there's an obvious sort of like exploiting religious, ethnic, racial tension there with cynical politics. But then the other part of me is just like, if you want to go there, like actually go there. But I'll let Alex just have a final word on this topic.
On the niqab issue?
Or on anything about the election in general.
Well, you started by asking whether this was an election about nothing. I'm not sure it's an election about nothing, but it's pretty devoid of substance. I mean, we're talking about niqabs and the NDP having one message in Quebec and one message in British Columbia and retail politics. The result is that major issues get left out. So as we touched on Indigenous peoples' issues, the landmark Truth and Reconciliation Commission report came out. How are parties planning to respond to the recommendations of the report? You know, what is the plan of the major political parties to address poverty? I'm not talking about the middle class or even working class Canadians. What about Canadians who don't have jobs? What about the thousands of homeless people on the street What are Canada's environmental commitments, especially looking forward to the next round of climate negotiations? Those are serious questions. Even as regards the TPP, people are making hay about whether or not this will impact the supply management system. We're not really having a conversation fundamentally about whether supply management should exist. The default position, even for conservatives, seems to be that we should continue this ineffective and regressive system, which actually does damage to millions of lower income Canadians. But maybe that's a discussion for another time.
I definitely think a discussion about, I think the thing about supply management is that, I'll be frank about this, the only reason any of the political parties really support it is because of rural votes. It's not a particularly defensible policy on economic grounds, even from left to right. If you ask any economist about that policy, regardless of what their other stances are, they'll say, yeah, that ought to be dismantled. They'll say the same thing about farm subsidies. People say, oh, the supply management isn't a farm subsidy because it's a farm subsidy in effect, right? So, whether it's the common agricultural policy in the EU or whether it's, United States farm subsidies, almost everybody who really considers those policies who doesn't have a vested interest in it will tell you that that's, a bad policy. Good discussion, guys. Do you want to get any last points in before we move on to the next topic?
No, I think I'm happy with what you've covered.
Okay, great. We're back again with the Ferris Current podcast. Our second topic tonight is we're going to be discussing the rise to prominence of Jeremy Corbyn, the newly, or I guess not newly at this point, he's been leader for about just under a month as we're talking and recording this, of the United Kingdom Labour Party. Of course, very long-time MP, was sort of seen on the fringe left of the party, rose to become the leader after only basically barely scraping onto the ballot. But I'm going to read, as a way of starting off this discussion, a quote just from the end of a critical piece that was run about Jeremy Corbyn in the New Statesman, the, I guess, centre-left, or whatever you want to call it, British political magazine. Sort of just talking about the ideological debate within the Labour Party that Corbyn, I guess, represents in certain ways. So just to briefly quote, I fear that the quiet life will win the day, that Corbyn will become entrenched and that a head-on doctrinal dispute will, as always, be avoided. For a century, fudging the issue has occasionally allowed Labour to build an election-winning big tent coalition of progressive voters. Today, that approach guarantees disaster. It will leave Corbyn free to promote his electorally toxic and economically destructive brand of left-wing politics. If that is what happens, Labour's tent will become a lot smaller and the party will cease to be fit for purpose. So, I guess I'll throw to Edward first. What do you think Jeremy Corbyn becoming leader of the Labour Party really represents in a broad sense about where, I guess, the British political scene, or maybe more specifically the British left, is going?
He represents, more than anything else in any, his election, more than any other development in recent global politics, with the possible exception of the election of Syriza, represents, what could be the stirrings of a new sort of post-neoliberal era, or certainly at least of a more open and direct resistance to the sort of, neoliberal economic consensus that, obviously going back started with Thatcher and Reagan and has since, since the 90s, spread and taken over most, previously center-left parties. So I think this represents a point where we're far enough away from the events of the 70s, the, stagflation and all the issues that sort of gave rise to this, particular brand of right-wing economic policy. We're far away enough from that that there are, and actually this is an argument which I'm taking, again, I'll mention just so I'm not sort of plagiarizing it, Matthew Iglesias at Vox made the argument that, you know, a lot of Corbyn's voters are young people who have, you know, were born since the 80s, who don't, in their memory, you know, remember the sort of what certainly at least the right would consider the sort of runaway welfare state that, you know, started to collapse in on itself in the 70s. All they've ever known is that the sort of dominance of this idea that, you know, the market must run things, that, quote, there is no alternative. And now they finally, you know, see a politician who is willing to say something else. They're refreshed by it. And, you know, so they're bringing, you know, a new breath, a new voice to the Labour Party that, you know, obviously supersedes Tony Blair, the New Labour Project, and all of that.
Well, I mean, I think the interesting thing that's kind of maybe even contradictory about that is the fact that Corbyn himself is, you know, he's an older guy, he's been around in the party since the 80s, and one of the things that you say, you know, the younger voters who maybe support him don't have a living memory of, you know, the, I guess, arguments that the Reaganite, Thatcherite right were making against, you know, quote, statist economic policies that came with stagflation in the 70s. They also don't have a memory of two other things. Firstly, the Cold War, which is to say that a lot of the sort of defense and security kind of debates that Corbyn, you know, has particularly strong opinions on were forged in that sort of Cold War discourse, in particular his opposition to Britain's independent nuclear deterrent, which is also usually termed Trident. And then the other thing that the younger voters don't really have a memory of is these sort of intra-left disputes within the Labour Party that within the 80s, you had Tony Benn representing the hard left of the party. You sort of had these Trotskyist interest groups within the party, a lot of sort of chaotic movement in local councils. This is where we get the term loony left from. So there were all these sorts of things that happened in the 80s that they don't have any memory of. And the sort of reaction in the press is Corbyn is, you know, we're going to go back to the 80s again. Labour's going to fight with itself and the Tories are just going to win forever. I guess to throw to Alex, is that an argument that washes with you? Or do you think that Corbyn is going to be a different thing than what happened with Labour in the 80s?
Is electorally toxic and economically destructive to describe Corbyn's politics. Because, firstly, if we've learned anything about the trajectory of left-wing parties in office from, for example, what's transpired in Greece, it is that whatever Corbyn promises is not what he's going to get, even if he forms government. And that's a result of larger forces than just internal British institutions as global financial institutions and global markets. But also, in terms of his appeal, I think he's the only politician in Britain today who can erect a tent big enough to accommodate old Labour voters who remember with considerable fondness the Labour Party of Tony Benn and Clement Attlee and Anoran Bevin on the one hand, and young, disaffected, un- or underemployed Britons on the other hand. So I think that we're not seeing, in spite of some colonists' predictions, a return to the labor of the 80s. I think the labor is going forward in a new direction. This new Labour Party, I think, in its policies and style will be much less statist and centrist than the old Labour Party. For example, Corbyn's championing of cooperatives and community-based economic stands in stark contrast to the sort of big centrist statist projects that characterize Labour government and the post-war consensus until Thatcher. So I think it's a bit simplistic.
But two is that, you know, unlike in the 80s, we're really coming into a period where on the right of British politics, you're going to maybe see some sort of crack up because there is going to be this referendum on EU membership. And a lot of people in a couple of years, and a lot of people are saying this is going to really, you know, people are saying, oh, well, you know, we see all this chaos with the quote chaos within the Labour Party. The shadow cabinet doesn't agree with Corbyn about a lot of things, in particular Trident renewal and his policy towards Syria. But the thing is, they're saying, well, you know, you probably are going to see a lot of infighting within the Tories as well, because there's a substantial portion of the Tories on the harder right of the party that don't want to be in the EU, and that's going to divide them, and then you're going to see both parties sort of fighting with each other, and perhaps the whole thing becomes a wash. So that would be the first thing to kind of bring into the table. But the second thing, and I think it's very interesting that Alex mentioned, is that, you know, there is a difference between the sort of, I guess you would say, centralist or statist sort of nationalization policies that, you know, the Labour Party pursued once it became government right after the Second World War, and then also Harold Wilson in the 60s really did nationalize a lot of things. And Corbyn has promised to nationalize a few things. He wants to bring rail and energy back into public ownership, but he isn't talking, for example, about like recreating British Steel or things like that, right? So there is at least, you know, some recognition that, like, well, we've moved on from that sort of industrial base. And this is the really big issue I want to get with. You know, the Labour Party and most social democratic parties throughout, you know, the Western world, whether that's Europe or, you know, in Canada, we have the NDP, kind of similar basis. And even, you know, to a certain extent, a certain chunk of the Democratic Party in the U.S., that's a bit different, but have always been conditioned that they draw the base of their sort of political power from the organized industrial working class, right? That's what the Labour Party moves out of. That's why they're called the Labour Party, right? They have their base in trade unions, etc. But we've seen a lot of changes in the nature of the economy. We've seen a lot of changes in the nature of, you know, where people are working, what they're doing, all that kind of thing. And because of that, you've seen these parties firstly, you know, shift towards the center, try to court the middle class, try to court, you know, maybe small business owners, people like that, beyond their traditional base. And I mean, that worked for a little while. I mean, you can say whatever you want about Tony Blair, but he was able to win the Labour Party elections, right? And I mean, this is similar to people like Gerhard Schroeder in Germany and places like that as well. But I guess the fundamental question is, at root, they still remain these sort of parties that are on the, at least somewhat conditioned on the idea that they're going to draw their political support from the organized working class, that there are these class-based conflicts within society that they represent one side of. Is that perhaps an outdated way of thinking about politics, or is it that, you know, it's just that that kind of politics was really silenced for a while, and now it's coming back in a big way? I'll throw it to Edward.
Class being a factor in politics, you are seeing certainly something of a comeback of that. I mean, at least rhetorically, I mean, the most obvious example was, you know, Occupy Wall Street, which at least introduced that into the discourse. To what degree that really resonated and caught on is obviously a question for debate. But at the same time, I feel like certainly, and see, this is the thing that might be changing, is that I think for the longest time we had this notion that of an extremely expansive notion of the middle class. When you talk about, as at least in terms of political rhetoric, it's constructed in such a large way that it you know, englobes. I mean, there's the actual middle class, which of course is difficult to define, but does exist. But there are a lot of people who, you know, in more classical terms might be considered, you know, working class, who have been sort of assimilated into it. And even people from sort of the lower reaches of the upper class. And it's just become this thing that politicians can appeal to without ever really having to define it, so that they can give this impression that they sympathize with working Canadian, or well, in this case, I guess working Britons, and you know, support them and everything. But you know, again, if you look at the way the rhetoric is constructed and who the many groups that have been sort of construed as belonging to this middle class, it obscures more than it actually explains or reveals. And so I think, you know, it's possible that we could start to see a breakdown of that, at, you know, as inequalities widen, you know, you could see a return to a more class-based politics in the sort of classical, you know, Marxian, socialist, you know, laborist sense. But it's at this point, I think it's hard to say, hard to predict whether that will be the case, at least in the short term.
Yeah. Well, I think the other sort of question you have to consider is that at least some of the political energy within that sort of sphere, let's say, that kind of like populist, anti-establishment sphere, hasn't in Europe been going to the left. It's been going to, and I'm hesitant to even call them the right in a traditional sense, but it's the sort of, there's a really excellent term, and I can't remember where I read it, but I love the term welfare nationalist. And these are parties like the Front National in France, the Danish People's Party, the Sweden Democrats, who combine these sort of very hardline cultural rightist stances, you know, very hardline about immigration, very assimilationist, and very anti-multicultural, but combining that with a traditionally sort of leftist, and either in some cases further to the left than the main social democratic party in those countries, stances on the welfare state, support for, in particular, the elderly. You can even see sort of examples of this in America. Certainly there's been some analysis around Donald Trump that says, you know, the way he constructs at least his rhetoric is designed to appeal to the same kinds of voters. But as far as it goes with Corbyn, I think he raised a really interesting point about the middle class there, because one of the successful things that Tony Blair was able to do was bring in those sort of like voters who maybe they weren't middle class in the traditional sense of the word, but they identified themselves as middle class. They were, you know, they called them the strivers. They were upwardly mobile. They might have a small business. They're trying to work their way up, kind of thing. And he kind of detoxified labor's brand. Those people saw labor as trying to hold people like them back, right? So he detoxified the brand. Problem is, in the last election, where Labour ran in a somewhat more left-wing direction, although that we can kind of talk about how questionable that is, they lost support on all sides and in all kinds of different ways. They lost that middle-class vote to the Tories. They lost a lot of their working-class base in the north of England to UKIP. For, again, these kind of cultural resentment sort of reasons. They lost Scotland to the Scottish National Party. To a lesser degree, they lost some seats in Wales to Plaid Cymru, who are the Welsh nationalists. So I guess the question I'll throw to Alex, and you can kind of take it any direction you want, is what's the metric for success of Corbyn's Labour Party? Like, what does he have to do to try and reconstruct a winning coalition or something like that?
I think he needs to do what he's been doing for the past 30 years, and that is speak truth to power. I think that has been the secret to his success. When the leadership race started, nobody serious with a capital S thought that Corbyn could win. And now that he has won, the powers that be are all of a single mind, and that is to find anything that can discredit him. Has this worked? Is the energy behind the Labour Party seeping out? I don't think so. And there's still about half a decade until the next election or more. So there's a long time for Corbyn to find where he fits into Parliament. I think he's done a good job during question time, actually bringing forward the concerns of Labour Party members and ordinary Britons and putting them straight to the Prime Minister. I think that David Cameron and those of his ilk, what they represent is, if we're going to talk about class, a very specific aging segment, venerable and ancient segment of the British population, but it's rapidly shrinking, especially in light of immigration. And, you know, if you look at the SNP,
and their success in Scotland, one of the biggest supporters was not, you know, traditional Labour voters. It was immigrants in the urban centres of the country. So I don't think it's necessarily true that these people coming into Britain are going to be more conservative and lean towards the Tories. I think that Corbyn will be able to attract a very large number of people, and maybe Labour will have more success amongst certain segments that traditionally it's had a hard time wooing.
What would some examples of that be?
Well, I think that in the South, for example, traditionally that's been a conservative stronghold. Certainly, Labour's always relied more on its northern support. But if suddenly the large chunk of young people in the South who aren't voting start voting, you could see the electoral map changing. Now, again, we have years before the next election, and I don't like to get into the business of predicting who will win which electoral districts and precisely how, but I am more optimistic in the ability of ideas to shape outcomes, and Corbyn has been pretty reticent when it comes to adopting divisive language, personal attacks, sort of things that characterize British politics and that the, you know, the bread and butter of the tabloids. He hasn't touched that, and it's worked for him. So I think maybe similar to what Obama managed to do in his first election, if he takes the moral high ground, if he sticks to his points about an anti-austerity ethic and sort of traditional Labour politics, it will only serve him well.
So I guess I'll throw to Edward now. The question I kind of want to ask is similar to the one I asked Alex, but it's more on, you know, the other prediction that some people have been making is, you know, does Corbyn even last as leader to the next election? Because he's going to have a bunch of tests, right? He's going to have this EU referendum. He's going to have the Scottish elections that are coming up. I guess that's the question. Do you think there's going to be some kind of palace coup against this guy? Because he is, you know, his politics are quite different than most of the parliamentary Labour Party, at the very least.
Future, as to whether he might face what you call a palace coup, I think that will depend largely on how the electorate, or at least the portion of the electorate as reflected in opinion polls, respond to him. Because I don't follow British politics terribly closely, but I feel like we're still not quite at a point where we can judge how ordinary Britons have reacted to his ascension to the leadership, to his brand of politics. And so as you go, he goes through all of these tests that you mentioned, I think that will have a very interesting fundamental bearing on whether he makes it to the next election. I mean, I think it's entirely possible that if, you know, if the sort of the punditocracy and sort of mainstream conventional wisdom is borne out, and that he's found to be, you know, too much of a fire-breathing communist throwback or what have you, and ordinary Britons turn against him, I think it's entirely possible he could be knocked out. I mean, it's obviously a very different party and slightly different situation, but look at what happened to Tony Abbott just recently, just within the past month. You know, he was doing so terribly in the polls that his own party was willing to boot him out in the hopes that replacing him would improve their standings in the polls. So I think that the mechanisms exist, and as you say, a lot of the existing Labour caucus might already have some, you know, ideological disagreements with him, which would make them even more willing and ready to exercise that kind of option if he causes the party to tank electorally.
Well, I think somewhat of the difference with Australia is just that that's really a pretty big part of Australian political culture, I guess, and the way the system functions there is that it's seen as a lot more normal and routine that you have these kind of leadership spills. It happened at least, gosh, in the past 10 years in the Australian Labor Party, it happened about 4 different times. So, you know, it's not... it would be a lot more unusual in the United Kingdom for that to happen.
That's true. Granted, there is a difference between those political cultures. So in Britain, look what happened to Thatcher. You know, she was...
Look at what happened to Ian Duncan Smith. Okay, so I guess a kind of further question coming off of that, and I'll throw to Alex here, is I guess, you know, do you think that there is a, you know, let's just talk politics or policies. Like, what do you think of Corbyn's ideas? Are they the right, you know, are they good ideas? Are they bad ideas? Because we've kind of talked a little bit about his economic policies, but one of the more sort of controversial elements of his thinking are his ideas about foreign policy. And, you know, to be frank, he's very much a pacifist, doesn't really want to get involved in any conflicts. He's made some sort of comments that people say were, you know, pro Hezbollah Hamas. The context there is deeply questionable as far as what he was actually saying, but certainly in the press it's played that way. I mean, do you think, you know, as the Tory tabloids are saying, you know, is this man dangerous for Britain or whatever?
Britain's role ever since the end of the Second World War has been in large part to act as a running dog of American imperialism. And I use that term non-ironically. And if America were to be stripped of the support it has come to count on from Britain, perhaps we would see the number of illegal interventions and sort of heavy-handed actions by the United States in the international arena decline. That would be my hope. He has, it's well known, Corbyn has said he would not use nuclear weapons. People have made hay about that. I would be scared of electing anybody who would enthusiastically agree to launching a nuclear holocaust on another population. I mean, the only time that's happened was in Japan, and actually there's a pretty good argument to be made that the Soviet involvement in the Pacific War was actually what brought the Japanese surrender, not Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I think from a strictly realist perspective, you'd have a hard time making the argument that the possession and deployment of nuclear weapons is in the national interest. Certainly, it makes no economic sense. And there's no proof at all that maintaining these facilities has been a deterrent to terrorists. It certainly hasn't kept the Fenians or the IRA or Sinn Féin under the English boot. So I think his policies are actually quite sensible. He's in the business of slaughtering sacred cows. And so, you know, the usual suspects from the Telegraph and elsewhere are going to be at his neck, but that's to be expected.
I mean, I think just to touch on policy, I think the thing, you know, the thing is, having tried it, if it ever made sense in the Cold War, it doesn't really make any sense anymore, because, you know, the fears that we have about sort of nuclear threats nowadays are more things like, oh, could terrorists get a suitcase nuke and put it in a major city center or something like that, whereas, you know, previously with the Soviet Union having nuclear weapons and, you know, to a later extent, Maoist China, it was basically, well, we need to have a certain number of nuclear weapons in order to get to mutually assured destruction, therefore they won't use them against us because they know we could kill all of them, right? There's an argument to be made about whether that holds, but it's at least a sound, reasoned argument. You can diagram it out on a flow chart kind of thing. You know, nowadays, if you have a concern about nuclear weapons, it's really not coming from that. It's coming from a loose nuke or something like that. So I think, you know, the public might be a lot more receptive to an anti-Trident message now than they were back when this was originally being debated in the 80s, because then Thatcher was when the policy of the Labour Party was unilateral disarmament, Thatcher was able to say, you know, there's a very famous political poster they had, which was just a man putting his hands up and dropping his gun, and it said Labour's policy on arms, right? And this was one of the biggest things they were able to make political hay out of, was that, you know, well, you know, what happens if the Soviets nuke us? We want to respond, kind of thing. You know, it's questionable, but that kind of, you know, there's a logic there. I guess I'll throw to Edward to kind of get closer to concluding the segment. Yeah, I'll ask you the same question I asked Alex. I mean, you know, what about his policies? If let's say, you know, all these predictions are wrong, something happens, the Tory machine falls apart, Jeremy Corbyn becomes prime minister. What then? I think
that would be a fascinating thing to see. Especially in terms of the a lot of the policies you were just talking about, nuclear arms, membership in NATO, which I'm pretty sure he's spoken against.
He has said he's against NATO, but similar to his like opposition to the monarchy, he says basically he accepts it and won't be bringing it into the public debate. I mean, I think when somebody asked him about it during the leadership contest, his response to the NATO question was, I would prefer we weren't in it. And then he sort of subsequently clarified, well, you know, I'm not going to really make an issue of it.
Again, with the case of the nuclear weapons, I think it could be interesting to see how that goes. Because like you say, we are in a much different context from when Trident was first created, first conceived of. The kind of threats that are sort of most talked about, obviously, terrorism they're not state actors, they're not the kind of actors against which mutually assured deterrence, even in theory, would work. And so I wonder if he does come to power, and if he does move in the direction of dismantling Trident, you know, I wonder, and this is almost maybe sort of preceding that, you know, I mean, what if he just makes the argument that, sure, maybe Trident worked at one point, but now it's clearly, you know, no longer useful. I mean, what if it's framed not even as a question of, you know, right versus left, as just a question of sort of, you know, then adapting to a new reality. However, the one caveat which I would put on that is, you know, I do wonder how, I don't want to exaggerate it, but obviously a lot of people are talking about sort of the rise of Russia with Putin and everything. And Putin, for instance, has not been afraid to talk about, you know, Russia's nuclear arsenal and how it allows them to project force. I don't think we're going to get to quite the level of tension that, you know, you saw during the Cold War. But I do wonder how, you know, the rise of a sort of nuclear-armed competing power who is much more explicitly hostile towards the West, towards Britain, towards the United States than it has been at any point since the end of the Cold War. I do wonder how that will play into the debate.
Well, the only thing I would sort of say about that in regards to Russia is that in recent, and this is kind of a different topic, but in recent days, Putin has kind of been trying to get the West back on side with him, you know, appealing, I believe the term he used was creating an anti-Hitler coalition against ISIS. And, you know, I think he's kind of recognizing that he's painted himself into a corner with the Crimea and the, you know, subsequent economic sanctions, the effect that's having on Russia, but that's kind of a different topic. I'll throw to Alex to have the final word about Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. I guess the other thing that a lot of people have expressed concerns about is not even really Corbyn himself, but the shadow chancellor he's chosen. He somehow found one of the only people in the Labour Party that is arguably to the left of him, to John McDonnell, who has a history of making, let's say, ill-considered remarks about various things. He mused about how he would like to go back in time and assassinate Margaret Thatcher. He said that the British government should honor the IRA, all that sort of thing. Now, you know, again, context, etc., etc. But he's certainly a bit more bellicose than Corbyn. Whatever else you want to say about Corbyn, he is quite soft-spoken in a lot of ways, very calm. I guess the question then sort of becomes, is this team going to be able to make a credible impression and be able to make genuine arguments to the British public that are winning? Because, you know, they have done a lot in terms of surrounding themselves with a good team of economists. They've got Thomas Piketty and Joseph Stiglitz and the former governor of the Bank of England, Danny Blanchflower, to be their economic advisor. So they're not, you know, they're not just coming in with a bunch of wild theories about how these things work. They seem to really be taking this seriously. Do you think it'll convince people?
Well, to get back to the fractions within the Labour Party, certainly there are divisions within the caucus, but even within the shadow cabinet, when Corbyn came out saying he would not use nuclear weapons, his shadow defense secretary said that his comments weren't helpful. I'm not exactly sure what that means. I think we can guess at the meaning, but I think that's indicative of some pretty serious ideological divides, both in terms of domestic and foreign policy, within Corbyn's inner circle, within the people in his party who he's handpicked to assist him. But I think what you see with the roundtable of economic advisors he's appointed, as well as with the people who make up his shadow cabinet, is a really firm and unwavering belief in the power of substantive discourse when it comes to developing policy. I think he recognizes the divisions in his own party, but it's not simple politicking. I don't think he's trying to unite the party for the sake of presenting a more united front to the Tories. I think he is genuinely interested, much as I think we all are, in having intelligent people who disagree sitting with him at the table. I think he does have an interesting choice when it comes to Chancellor of the Exchequer, shadow critic, but he also has voices on that shadow cabinet significantly to his right. And I think that, as I've said about the Liberal Democrats in the past, that intellectual diversity can actually serve as a strength. I think you're going to get more considered, thoughtful policies. It's not a Trotskyist cabal that's come to the helm of the party, far from it. And the more that he can feel like, make people in this party feel like they're being heard and maybe incorporate some of the concerns, the stronger their party is going to be and the stronger their policies are going to be.
I definitely think one of the big things he's come out with is a really strong commitment to intra-party democracy in terms of letting the policy conference, you know, actually set the parliamentary policy. So I definitely agree with you there. All right, well, good discussion on that topic, guys, and we'll now move on to the reading recommendations.
What is due to developing countries and developed countries, who should control what, and the difficulties of reform, which is widely acknowledged as necessary, and sort of an accounting of why reform in the UN is so difficult and what hope there is moving forward. So if you have some time, I encourage you to check that out.
It's definitely a very interesting article in the way it presents it, because it's not, you know, a lot of the sort of UN, you know, the UN is bloated, blah, 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 kind of takes this very negative tone, but that article is actually quite balanced in terms of saying, yes, it has become bloated in certain ways, and maybe it is corrupt in certain ways, but it also does an immense amount of good in the world. So it is kind of about that balanced perspective, and I really like the article for that reason. Okay, so Edward, your recommended reading.
All right, so mine comes obviously in a context where over the past couple of days, past week or so, Putin is having sort of another one of his moments as he sends Russian troops to intervene in Syria. He was at the UN to give a big speech trying to sort of present his justification for this. And actually, we alluded to this earlier in the podcast. That was where he proposed sort of an anti-Hitler coalition with the West to ally forces and take down ISIS. But the one that I would suggest people read was on Vox.com, written by Amanda Taub. Full title, just for reference, is Putin's Syria Intervention Isn't Grand Brilliant Strategy, It's an Act of Fear. And the argument that she makes, and I find quite interesting, is, she points out, like, a lot of people have said, Putin has moved into Syria, he's checkmated Obama, and, he's wrong-footed the administration, and so on and so forth, which brings up, actually, just a quote that I really liked from another article on the subject. Someone said, Putin's greatest fan club outside of the former Soviet Union always tends to be, Washington newspaper hacks. So what she lays out is actually the idea that this isn't some, sort of part of a grand design that he's now, achieved some strategic superiority over the West, but rather that this was an act of desperation driven, and this is the part that I find is most interesting about the article and why I most recommend it, by a very particular worldview that Putin has, the way he conceives of, especially over the past couple of years, popular uprisings, state actors against non-state actors, terrorists especially. Obviously I'll leave it to interested listeners to read the thing themselves. But in a way, what kind of emerges out of it is, I think, actually a more coherent worldview for Putin than maybe a lot of people will hear, especially from the mainstream press. Where what they're basically arguing is, he's for instance been very marked by the experience of Libya, where the guy who he allowed to temporarily replace him as president, Medvedev, not exactly signed on for, but basically, abstained and therefore allowed the West to bomb and overthrow Gaddafi, notionally stopping, a massacre in Benghazi and everything, but leading to, and of course, an underreported sort of low-intensity civil war. And he sees this as, the future of what could happen to Syria if Assad is thrown out. And so I think what this really gives that's interesting is, to 60 Minutes, he gave an interview where he basically said, the solution to Syria is to reinforce the effective state structures and fight terrorism, which it's easy for us to say, oh, that's just cynical, that's just his propagandistic way of justifying supporting Assad. But, I think there might be something more genuine in that than we're willing to admit, where he just really has this worldview that any kind of revolution in the world will inevitably end in instability and terror.
Yeah, I found that article fascinating on a lot of levels. And I mean, I think I agree with you about, what it says about Putin's worldview. It's interesting, it's a fundamentally conservative sort of worldview. And I mean that in a kind of like, almost like Clemens von Metternich sort of sense. Like, there are states in the world, we want stability, that's the only thing that matters. And if you read articles about Putin's advisors, they all kind of think in this way. It's all about just preserving stability. I found that really fascinating. But I also found the other thing about the article is, it kind of puts a lie to this notion that I think sometimes gets bandied around, that every sort of rival to the West is this, grand master of political strategy. They have us all wrong-footed. You see the same sort of rhetoric coming out about China or Iran. You know, the phrase that I always sticks in my brain is, you know, Putin is playing chess and we're playing checkers, that kind of thing. And it's like, no, like, sometimes these people are just as, you know, making these decisions on the fly, reacting to events as they occur. They don't have this grand strategy. It's very similar to the way our political leaders, you know, react to events. It's just that we don't see all the internal things because, A, we're not in those countries, and, B, they have, in most cases, they have sort of closed leadership systems. They're black boxes, so we can't really see those sort of internal dynamics working themselves out.
And one thing I will just say really quickly is the article also addresses the degree to which Putin himself almost seems to perceive the West in similarly sort of monolithic, hostile terms. Like, it explains that in Putin's view, any kind of popular uprising or demand for greater democracy, you know, especially in the Middle East, but also in Ukraine, for instance, is part of this sort of, you know, Western cultural imperialism, Western ideas being imposed. And, you know, in the most extreme cases, he is even, you know, said things verging on conspiracy theory, where, you know, the CIA is behind this and that. And, you know, the note that I love that the article ends on is really just that, you know, at the same time that Putin is, you know, mistakenly under the belief that, you know, the West is actively trying to promote some kind of Trotskyist permanent revolution to, you know, overthrow all dictators around the world, you know, it kind of mirrors our own misperception of him as some kind of grand chess master who's looking to, you know, rebuild the Russian Empire in its former glory.
Okay, so the article that I chose as a highly recommended reading is a pretty short article from The Atlantic. It's basically, it turns out that today, October 3rd as we record this, is actually the 50th anniversary of the United States' 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act. Which is a significant change in U.S. immigration policy. It basically eliminated the use of national origin quotas as a way of deciding who should get to come into the country, and it made it basically a points-based system or category-based system where people could come in. And this law, even though it was pitched as a sort of, like, small-ball maneuver, actually had a really big impact on the demographics of the United States. It made it a much more multi-ethnic society. People were coming in from places other than Europe in large numbers for the first time as a result of this act. So it's basically, the article is kind of a short history of the legislative history of the act, the way it got constructed, and then the way it was pitched to the public at the time. And it's very interesting because, you know, it was pitched and even consciously constructed as a small act, but it had really big impacts on the United States' demographics and that sort of thing, and really did change the country. So yeah, definitely read that. And it kind of goes along slightly with what we were talking about earlier in terms of, you know, that was also around the time where Canada changed its immigration policy and also instituted multiculturalism as official government policy. Of course, the United States didn't do the second part of that. They didn't institute multiculturalism, but certainly they changed their immigration policy. So it's an interesting article. It's fairly brief. And the fascinating thing I found about it is that one of the main drivers of the increase in ethnic diversity in the United States as a result of the act was the family reunification provisions. And the interesting thing about that is that those provisions were actually inserted into the act by somebody who did, a legislator who didn't want ethnic diversity to increase. And his thought was, if we have these family reunifications, it'll fill up the quotas with people who are related to the kinds of people who are already here, i.e. Northern and Western Europeans. But subsequently, that's actually one of the main drivers of immigration from third world countries into the United States. So it's interesting, the sort of ways in which the intent of acts can often produce just the opposite results. So for both myself and Edward and Alex, I thank you for listening to this episode of The Affairs Current. If you have any comments, questions, complaints, please email us at affairscurrent@gmail.com. Our blog, once again, is theaffairscurrent.blogspot.com. Alex, do you have anything to say as a closing?
No, it's been a pleasure, and I hope that I'll be back in the future bringing more of an Asian perspective to the program.
And Edward, do you have anything to say?
Just to say that I'm glad to be back again. I hope I'll be back again in the future. And as always, I quite enjoyed the discussion.
Okay, well, I thank you too for the discussion. And yeah, so hopefully we'll hear from everybody here again real soon. All right, have a good night, guys.